Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jana Byers, and I'm here today with David Onekink, professor of early modern history at the University of Utrecht here in the Netherlands, to discuss his latest book, The Delightful, The Dutch in the Early Modern World, A History of Global Power, out 2019 with Cambridge University Press. Oh, stumbling over my own mouth. Hello, David, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, good morning, and thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining me. How are you?
I'm very good. Sort of seeing the snow disappearing outside of the window and still in lockdown, of course, but all the time of the world to read books, right?
Right.
Yep.
Did you skate this weekend?
I didn't. I'm a very bad skater, but our house sort of overlooks a small channel, and we saw the people skating, and it's delightful. It's like, you know, watching 17th century Dutch paintings. It's great.
It really is. For our listeners, we're recording in mid-February 2021, and we have winter in the Netherlands right now. And it is, I mean, as David said, it's delightful. The ponds and the smaller waterways are frozen. We've got some snow. Everyone was outside and enjoying it over the weekend. And the stereotypes tend to be true. Dutchies love their winter, love to skate.
That is true. And it's the sort of winter we thought we wouldn't have anymore, you know, because of global climate change. It's really warming up here. But finally, we have ice and snow. So
We're always worried it'll be our last good winter. But, you know, I went into the center this weekend. I live right outside the center. And it was just gorgeous. There was a nip in the air. Dutch flags were flying from 17th century windows and lanky blondes were racing down frozen canals on their skates. It was this picture perfect Dutch scene. And I was just coming off reading this book, right? And so I was just overwhelmed by the connection between this place and this history. These homes built from the wealth garnered through the global trade seemed to like drive home everything I'd read. And it was stunning. So my first question for you is an unusual one, possibly personal, possibly silly. I'm not sure, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Like, as a Dutchman and an historian of the early modern period, do you feel this connection sometimes?
Yeah, you feel the connection because you are really living in a museum, of course, and especially if you're living in one of the old Dutch cities like me. I'm living in Utrecht, which is really a sort of late medieval 17th century city. So you're living inside, but on the other hand, you know, if you've traveled around, I've traveled a bit. I also noticed that, you know, the Netherlands is not just the Netherlands, you know, it's part of a bigger world, and we go abroad and the world comes here. So, it's the past, but it's also the present that are intimately connected, and that's fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. This is, I mean, Utrecht is this beautiful, and it's older than Amsterdam, and it has like a more medieval center, but you can still see the golden age there as well, the so-called golden age. But it's interesting. This history really drives home your point, though, that the Dutch go everywhere and everyone comes here. And that's a pretty important part of the history of the Dutch Republic. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it is a fascinating history. And of course, if you live in the Netherlands, we tend to feel that our country is unique, which of course it isn't. But it's still a fascinating story to tell. And that's what, of course, we try to do in this book.
Well, everyone's unique, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
All right. So intellectually, this book is right in your wheelhouse. So your first book, The Anglo-Dutch Favorite, The Career of Hans Willem Bentinck, First Earl of Portland, is a bit of a biography, but mostly you use him as a vehicle to explore the power of the Dutch Republic in the late 17th century. And then your second work, De Geur van Utrecht, which translates to The Peace of Utrecht, talks about, and I'm going to quote from the publisher here, quote, the First Worldwide War, the War of Spanish Succession, ended in 1713 with the Peace of Utrecht. The Dutch Republic, allied with England and her empire, played a key role in this conflict that was fought in both Europe and North America and is still considered fundamental for modern international relations. So we've got that. And then articles and essays you publish show more of an interest in the Reformation and cultural history, but still international relations. So this book is very logical it's a logical next step for you. But at the same time, it's much more global rather than European in scope. And so I'm wondering how you chose to move in that direction.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, it's a good question, and you sort of reflect on your own sort of development as a historian. I was trained as a historian of diplomacy and international relations, as you say, and here in Utrecht we have a department of history of international relations, which is really contemporary, right? So we reflect on European Union and NATO and all that. But I really wanted to do the older history, but it's boring history in a sense, you know, international relations, you know, the classic diplomatic history is completely out of fashion since the 1960s and 70s.
Sexy. No,
but of course it changed, and that's why my interest developed, because, you know, ever since, you know, the early 21st century, obviously after 9/11, we realized that international relations is not just about, you know, the military or the diplomacy itself. You know, it's about much more. It's also about culture. It's also about religion. And that's why my interest developed. But because my first book, as you mentioned, Earl of Portland, who was the favorite of William of Orange, you know, the famous King of England after the Glorious Revolution, he was a Calvinist. He was a devoted Protestant, and you see that foreign policy connected with religious views and also cultural views, you know, and sort of an anti-French sentiment which developed in these times. So what I try to do is to sort of connect to a process that's been going on in this field, and to see international relations also as a cultural phenomenon. And that's why I became interested in Portland, but also in the Peace of Utrecht, which is a founding moment for European diplomacy. But also for a European culture in which people started to think not just about war, but for instance, also about peace. And so what connects us as Europeans? Do we actually have one culture, a European culture that binds us? And could that be a foundation for peace? So in that sense, you know, my research developed from classic diplomacy into a sort of European cultural history, and as you say, lately in this latest book, in sort of a global history of the Dutch Republic, in which we still try to connect to, you know, to diplomacy and warfare, because there was a lot of warfare, unfortunately, in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. But it's not just about that. It's not about treaties and battles. It's about a lot more, and that's what we really try to do in this book.
So you say we, and I think it's probably a good time to talk about your co-author, Gijs Ramelse, who died unexpectedly entirely too young in November of last year at the age of 42, yeah?
That's correct, yes. No, it was it was an enormous shock. And he was my co-author, but also a very good friend. We've been friends for about 20 years. And yeah, we wrote this book together because it was a really good cooperation, because we really helped each other with writing this. We have complementing expertises and also complementing personalities. So it worked really good, and I really miss him. But it's good to mention that this book is as much, probably more so his book than mine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you say you have complementing specialties. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's right. So Gijs and I, we've been really good friends, and we studied together in London 20 years ago, and Gijs was really specialized in economic history. That was really his forte, and also naval history. And of course, you cannot write about the Dutch in the 17th century without, you know, the economic expansion, East India Company and all that, and the economic boom that really was part of the Dutch miracle in the late 16th and 17th century. And I, as I said, was more interested in diplomacy and European history. So we thought, you know, this is really something we can do together. So basically what we did is we alternated chapters. So he wrote about his themes and I wrote about my themes. And of course, we talked a lot to each other about how we should develop this book. But it's really a joint enterprise, a bit of a challenge as well.
Yeah.
But how it worked out all right, I'll leave that to the reader.
Yeah, no, I think so. Collaboration is really rare in history. There are places where they do it all the time. It seems like the people in the hard sciences never work alone. But it's still pretty rare in history to write with others. And it seems to have worked very well here. Did you talk a lot while you were writing? Did you read each other's work and comment?
Yeah, both. But you're right. You know, it's really hard to write history together. And especially for me, I really like to work alone. It's like, you know, we historians feel that we have a sort of intuition and we can choose anecdotes and stories that we really feel explain what we're trying to say. So it is a part. It's sort of an individual enterprise. But it worked out all right because we talked a lot, and before we actually started writing, we discussed how we were organizing this book. And basically, we did a bit of both, right? So we wrote our own sections, and we had complete freedom within those sections. But before we did that, we really discussed how we were going to divide the sections and what the sections should be all about. So if you look at the book, it has a very clear structure. It's very clearly organized, but within that organization, we felt we had a lot of freedom to do our thing. And then, of course, we read each other's chapters over and over again and discussed them and threw bits out. And, you know, that's how it works. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to say just I'm very sorry about your loss of your friend. And as an historian as well, I read a dedication, a story of his life. And it ended with Gijs had a hat in snelle pen and groot hart, a quick pen and a big heart.
That's right. Yeah.
That's about as kind an epitaph as an historian can hope for.
I think so too. And it's absolutely true in his case. Yeah. Well, thanks for noticing this.
Yeah. So one of the things, and when I was reading this, I was really shocked by how, and I mean shocked because it's so good, but it's so rare, that this book is so scaffolded and you introduce what you're going to do and it there's a symmetry to it you don't see very often. And that makes sense to think about how you would have discussed this and then set out to write your own parts, but make them speak to each other.
Yeah, that's right. And in a sense, for us, it was also a learning process. You know, if you write a book on your own, you feel a little bit more liberty to develop a specific structure. But here we felt, you know, we really have to do it like this, or it becomes a more of a thing. But the other thing is we also wanted to, you know, write for a sort of general interested public, but also specifically for students. And we thought, you know, students really sort of first need a sort of short overview and then get into the details. And also because we are both teachers, that's may actually help us, have helped us to develop this particular structure. You know, for students, it's really helpful to know what they're going to read about before actually reading all this stuff about which they think, why do I need to know this, right? So I think our background explains a little bit why we did it like this.
Speaking of, this book comes with an extensive and useful front matter, historical maps, including a Netherlands that is almost unrecognizable from 1648. A chronological list of town officials, pensioners is the Dutch term, or is the term that the Dutch use, and provincial executives, which is stadtholders. Very detailed timeline. And these things are rarer in academic historical monographs than one might think. So I was thinking that this was a good clue to your intent, that this was meant for students, but also non-specialists too.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a fine balance, right? Because you also want your colleagues to be interested in what you write, and at the same time attract a different kind of public. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah.
You know, I read this cover to cover, which is, I will admit, I rarely do that with academic historical books. You know, that's not what they're built for. And as I told you before we started recording, I've passed this along to my partner who does some sort of software tech business. Uh-huh. I don't know. I can't pay attention. Because it's just readable and accessible and explains where we live. But I learned a great deal as well as an early modern historian. So you managed both. Well done.
Thank you.
I think part of that is your source materials. Let's talk about that. What did you find most useful? What did you use and what did you love?
Well. First of all, we sort of learned a little bit with the book I wrote on the Peace of Utrecht, which is in Dutch and which is on a very limited topic. But I sort of realized, and this is the thing: if you're an academic historian, you spend so much time doing very detailed stuff, which only a couple of colleagues will actually read. And we both felt, you know, there's so many interesting things which are slightly outside of your expertise. And there's you know, talking with Haroon and the Sea of Stories, you know, there is a sea of stories out there. There is so much material and so many interesting things happened. And we were simply captivated by the stories. So that's really, I think, part of the thing that drove us. And as you can, as you say, you know, in the book, there's a lot of argument, you know, an official story, but also a lot of tiny stories, which to me as a historian become more interesting and interesting, you know, the micro history, the small stories, the personal issues and how they connect to a much bigger story. But from a pragmatic point of view, you cannot research all of this. That is impossible for a monograph like this, right? Because you're dealing with 300 years of history, and it's a global history, so it's impossible to rely on primary sources. So what we did is we see this as a synthesis, you know, a sort of an overview of the research that's been done by our colleagues over the last 20, 30 years. The latest insights, you know, new developments. But inside, we felt the liberty to, you know, include all kinds of anecdotes and small stories. And we picked a number of primary sources which we thought were fascinating and sort of visualize the story. And also, maybe we can talk about this if we have time, but I also realize that, and Gijs as well, because we got a fellowship from the Amsterdam Maritime Museum, where we wrote part of this book, we realized that a lot of historians like us don't use visual material, right? We really believe that history is text. And so we included also analysis of paintings, but also actually physical objects. And as you started, you know, this meeting, talking about the city, and we realized that, you know, the history is all around us. You know, the houses we see in central Amsterdam, you know, they are part of the story as well. So we really wanted to include that story as well.
Yeah, and you include a lot of those, like images. There's a figure one is a striking aerial photo of Fort Boutang in eastern Groningen, mm-hmm. right? There's a delightful painting of a Dutch man of war ramming a Spanish ship that I have to admit, like, made me cheer. Satirical cartoons, you know, the like, so it's, you really do. This book is, you know, there's this chronological story and then I feel like you stop the story and take a second and look at a topic in detail, which is really enjoyable. And that's a place where you really do this conversation about the material culture, the, as you say, the objects, the buildings, which humanizes, narrows it. It brings the story to a small enough place where I think that it really shines, and you get to look at these little things, these little micro stories, as you say, that tell the bigger story.
Yeah, that's right. And I really, as an historian, I actually, of course, for an art historian, this is not new, but as an historian, I really learned to look. And I remember that specifically one moment in the Maritime Museum, and we were actually writing an article on the 17th century Navy, and there's this incredibly wonderful painting of a battle. And, you know, naval battles in the 17th century, paintings of naval battles are absolutely boring and people skip them, and for good reason. But that's right. But what we notice is if you just sit there, and I actually looked at the painting for 1 hour, just looking, right? Not asking questions, not analyzing, but just looking at what you see. And suddenly there was a world out there. You know, you saw the faces of individual people. We saw flags of specific cities, and we wondered, you know, why are these flags represented? Is it about culture, or is it about war, or obviously it's about both? And we saw all these tiny details, you know, a number of Spanish people who were actually, you know, drowning in the sea, and we found anecdotes about what actually happened. And suddenly we realized that, you know, a painting says so much about what you need a lot of words for to describe. And again, of course, if you're an art historian, this is not something new, but we try to integrate all this together. And for us, it was a very enjoyable, but also a sort of learning curve. Yeah, to do this. And as you say, to go back to your question, you know, we felt we really needed to tell the story. So some of the things we wrote are really the sort of classical story of the Netherlands, the Dutch Revolt. And, you know, we need to know all these things about high politics, how the Spanish sort of tried to get the Netherlands back in the late 16th century, about the battles that took place, because battles are actually important. But we also realized that the battles are not something you can write about cleanly from a distance and, you know, who won and who didn't win. But it's also a very human story. And I remember writing about these battles that I gave a presentation a couple of years ago. And I gave a presentation on the Peace of Utrecht and one of the famous battles that took place in the 18th century that you know, we don't really care about anymore, because it's not really about the battle. It is about the story and how humans experience this. But what I came across, and I remember that my public, and that for me was a sort of learning moment, my public responded to one particular illustration. And that was not of the battle. It was not of any of the arguments I put forward. It was an engraving of a horse that actually died on the battlefield. And it was such a beautiful engraving. And so much detail of the horse that was sort of falling down. And there is actually a series. So Van Huchtenberg, who was a 17th century painter, but he made a number of sketches of these horses that he actually must have seen, I presume, on the battlefield, because they were so lifelike. And suddenly we thought, you know, this is a way to combine, you know, the big story, which is important, to a very small and tiny story and of the things that, you know, are almost forgotten. I mean, who cares about a dying 17th century horse? You know? Well, of course, there's the movie now about the war horse, but yeah. But so, I mean, it's not original, but you know, we try to combine all these things. And yeah, so.
Yeah. Okay. This is my favorite kind of history. Let me say that. I'm just making noises now, so let me actually use words. I particularly love the study of material culture and how that leads. I consider myself a microhistorian as well, and it's my favorite history to read. So I want to take a minute to talk about a couple of the small stories that you tell. Along the way. And one of my favorite examples is your discussion of the Dutch identity. So there's a place, like, I would like you to talk about the process, how you managed this, what you did, like the sources you consulted, and kind of the arguments you come to about the development of a Dutch identity in the early modern era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that is a fascinating story. And you know, there's been a lot of debate among Dutch historians about how Dutch identity evolved. And the classic story is really that, you know, the Dutch tried to gain independence from the Spanish. But that is a little bit complicated. But yeah, in a sense, just like in the United States, you know, what is the actual identity of the Netherlands before the Dutch Revolt? And that's very difficult because the country you have now as the Netherlands never used to be a country in the first place. It was always part of a bigger, what they call a dynastic conglomerate, which is a technical term to explain that all the states in early modern Europe, you know, basically were part of a dynasty. Of course, it doesn't mean that there were no identities. There were local identities, provincial identities, religious identities, obviously, that developed. And they're all layered identities, right? But how do you create a state with an identity? Well, it didn't really occur to people that they needed an identity because, of course, that's really a 19th century thing, that we need a specific identity as a state. But still, what you see developing in the late 16th century is that a lot of citizens in the Low Countries feel that they are very different from the Spanish and the King of Spain that rules over them. At the same time, it is seen as a civil war. So there's actually a lot of people who are loyal to the Spanish and they remain Catholic. It's not simply a war of the Spanish against the Dutch. So that heroic story is a little bit complicated now. But at the same time, you see that people start to develop an identity, and it's very much related to the Dutch revolt. So there's been some recent research in how individual people as well, you know, they prize themselves, they feel they are patriot because they have actually fought against Spain. And then you sort of see the development of a dual identity. You know, a Dutch patriot is someone who fights against, you know, the Spanish Empire and is a good Protestant. And they become the sort of first rank citizens. But the next step, of course, is how do you visualize this? You know, how do you make clear that this is what we are? Now, one of the things they do is to go back to Roman age. So there was a revolt of Batavia, which was a province of the Roman Empire, in which the Batavians fought against the Roman Empire. And so you see the development of what they call the Batavian myth. So we've done the same, you know, we've done it 1500 years ago against the Romans, and now we do it against the Spanish. But this is really sort of for the intellectual elite. And the other thing you need is to keep so the Netherlands consists of a number of provinces. You know, eventually they become seven provinces, and these sort of are rivals. You know, they really don't always work together. But then they come up with this imagery of a lion with seven arrows, for instance. You know, only if the lion holds the seven arrows together, then we can keep the unity. So all these sort of images develop, and it's not quite a national identity in the modern sense. A lot of historians don't believe that there is such a thing, but other historians increasingly realize that at least you see a development towards some sort of a national identity. And the pictures are really interesting here. So the lion with the seven arrows, there's a picture of a garden, it's called the Dutch Garden. And it's really visualized the territory which is shielded from the Spanish. And all these images sort of develop in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm. And a point that you make very well is that this the identity isn't just conducted in opposition to the Spanish, but in concert with local identities. So you can be Dutch and... right. And that also this is a multi-level. This is not just a top-down kind of... projection.
Yes, absolutely. So it's complex. You know, it's not a single identity. People don't have a single identity. They have multiple identities, but a state in a sense also. And in the Netherlands, which is incredibly localized, you see, as you say, you see that, you know, the cities and the provinces and the state all try to, you know, put forward their identity, and it becomes a very complex unit. And basically, what I did in my research, which is not in this book, but goes back to the painting I saw. This was a painting of one of the battles I described, and you can see a lot of flags, and you see the Dutch flag, and you see provincial flags, and you see local flags, but you also see religious flags. And in a sense, the painting shows us how incredibly complex a state, or more to the point, how incredibly complex a nation is. And also, of course, how identity is not something fixed, but sort of changes through time and through circumstances. And this, I think, is one of the main things we wanted to tell in this book, It's also about the development and complexity about Dutch identity, which, as the book I think also explains, is not really Dutch at all. That's maybe we can talk about later.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and it's important, and it's a timely point, as one of, you know, is in everywhere in Europe and possibly the world. Our discussion of like identity and what it means to be Dutch now is such a heated and, you know, an incredibly closely held discourse. It's important to remember that that's a very old discussion.
Yes, no, that's right. It's an old discussion, the development and of identity, and also the development of opposing identities, because that's of course how identities become very strong. You know, what we are is basically what the enemy is not, and mm-hmm. that is part of an ongoing ancient story that of course changes all the time. But the basic ingredients of this process are in a sense always the same.
Right. Another small case history I want to discuss is the story of Maurice, the Prince of the Netherlands, and his in his relationship with the Shogun of Japan. Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners about this?
Yeah. No. This is interesting. So so the Netherlands becomes a global power basically, and I think one of the stories we tell is, it's about the West Indian Company that operates in the Atlantic and mainly North and a little bit South America, and the East Indian Company that operates in Asia and the Indian Ocean. And the East India Company becomes the first stock market, stock operated company in the world. And that is a fascinating story in itself. The problem here, however, is that it is a commercial company. It is not, and that's very much unlike the Spanish Empire, of course. It's not operated by the sovereign or the king. It is a commercial company operated by merchants. It is still connected, however, to the state. But in a sense, you know, it's the merchants that decide what they're going to do. But what do you do if you're a merchant and you want to trade in Japan? And in Japan, you have a shogun, and the shogun, you know, he wants to maybe start diplomatic relations. Now, the East India Company can start diplomatic relations. But how do you, you know, start diplomatic relations as a merchant? So you say, you know, basically, they argue, we come in the name of the sovereign of the Netherlands. But there's a problem, because the Netherlands don't have a sovereign, because they got rid of the King of Spain. So what do we tell them? So basically you lie. So basically you say, you know, we have Prince Maurice, who is, and maybe for the listeners, so in the Netherlands you don't have a king. There is a prince, but he's not Prince of the Netherlands, but he has a noble title and he has some important offices in the Netherlands. But basically what they say, you know, we present him as a king, and then suddenly you have two kings. You have the shogun, who by the way is also not a king, but still, you know, the actual ruler of Japan, and you present Maurice as the king of the Netherlands, and suddenly it works, and you have a sort of diplomatic balance that seems to work out. And the story of Japan is fascinating anyway, because of course the Dutch were after 1652 the only Europeans that were allowed to trade in Japan for about 200 years, and that alone is a remarkable story.
So the VOC, does the VOC have to do a lot of this, right? Like negotiating and figuring out who it is, and how to deal with foreign powers.
Yeah. So especially, you know, if we have the image of, if we think about European imperialism, you know, we really have the image that, you know, the Europeans are mightier, you know, they have the technological advantage, they have military advantage, you know, and they come there and they, yeah, you know, they basically build an empire. But in the 17th century, still, this is a lot more complicated. So there are places where the Europeans are absolutely superior. And you see this, of course, in the New World, well, not in the first stages, but later, you know, this develops very quickly in Latin America with the Spanish Empire. But in Asia, this is a very different story, because a lot of these, you know, places, they have kingdoms that are very well organized and economically, militarily, politically very strong and solid. So you just don't come there and conquer, you know, the place where you are. So basically the East India Company needs to find out and check, you know, what is our position in the place that we are. And in some of the places, you know, they can actually, they have military power. So a famous example for the Dutch is, of course, Indonesia, Batavia, where they are a lot stronger. Taiwan, which is conquered for a while. But Japan is a very different story because Japan is a very centralized and strong state. And here you cannot come with guns and cannons. You have to find in your way by diplomacy. So basically what the VOC, the East India Company, does is they try to figure out their position in the regional power game. And it's basically different everywhere. And so you can't say that the VOC has a dominant or not a dominant position in Asia. It really depends on local circumstances. And what you see is the Dutch, just like the Portuguese and the British, they just become one of the regional powers in Eastern Asia. And this changes, of course, in the 19th century. But in the period that we are studying, everything is a lot more in flux. And of course, that's, you know, also makes it a very complicated but also fascinating story. And they have to find ways to get in because they want to earn money. You know, they want to trade, and they do anything, basically. The Dutch have a terrible reputation. All of the European powers say, now, the Dutch would do anything to trade. You know, they don't believe in God. They only believe in money. And to an extent, that is actually true.
Well, I mean, it also doesn't, I mean, like this is done in part, that reputation comes from the fact that it's no one's trading with the Dutch government, or you're trading with a company, right? I mean, it's not like you're not talking to a church member or something when you're dealing with the VOC.
No, that's right. But at the same time, you know, this the whole story that, you know, this is, you know, the Spanish were interested in God and gold, right? So they sent the Jesuits and they sent, you know, the traders and the military. And the story is that, you know, the Dutch weren't really interested. But lately, especially over the last 2 or 3 years, there's been done a lot of research to say, you know, this is too simplistic, because on the East India Company ships, there were a lot of ministers, and they actually tried to establish contacts with religious groups in well, not so much in Japan because it was forbidden, but for instance on Ceylon, and also in Batavia, there were a lot of people converted to Christianity. Taiwan was a spectacular success for thousands of Chinese converted to Christianity. So the story is, you know, the whole, and this is a story that Dutch historians have really in the past brought forward to say, you know, we didn't, you know, spread European civilization. We were just there to trade. But we realize now that the story is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. That's such a great thing about history. You know, we have this idea of what happened and we're constantly refining and nuancing it. It's really wonderful. Yeah. So we're closing in on the end of our time here. So I want to tie up a few loose ends. So first question, you start with Henry Hudson. Was this a deliberate choice?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is deliberate in the sense that part of the reason I started to write this book, well, together with Gijs, of course, was of my teaching experience in the United States. And I was I spent some time in William & Mary College in Virginia and UCLA in Los Angeles, which were both unforgettable, very different places, of course, but both wonderful places to be. And I interacted with students, me as a Dutch teacher and American students, and we talked about these issues. And I gave a course on the Dutch Golden Age, and I was very happy to see that students were interested, obviously because there is a connection between the Netherlands and the United States. But I also found out that, you know, of course, their perspective on Dutch and more generally on European history is very much different from my own perspective. And you know, I learned a lot from my students in the time I spent there. But I think part of the reason why we started this book with Henry Hudson was that we wanted to show that, you know, Dutch history is not simply Dutch history. It is connected to global history, what we just talked about. And it's, by the way, it's not just Dutch people who went abroad. You know, most of the people who are in the service of the East India Company and the West India Company were actually foreigners. About 50 or 60% of those people were Europeans, Germans, British, Norwegians, and all that. But Henry Hudson, of course, is a famous example of someone who was an Englishman in the service of the Dutch East India Company, who explored part of what later became America. We really wanted to tell this story, how all these things are connected, that U.S. history is also intimately connected to Dutch history. And this you know, this example really comes from that period I spent in the United States.
Yeah, I can see that influence. And I think it also is an interesting, it's a good way to tie in with how you close, or not quite close the book, but when you talk about the exploitation, right? Because the story of the global expansion in the early modern era has a lot to do with the exploitation of some unwilling participants.
Yes, the involuntary migration. Yeah, so we talk about a lot about migration. So we argue that, you know, the Dutch Republic is a hub of global migration, of European migration. So a lot of people, you know, travel to Amsterdam in the 17th century because that's where the work is. You know, so Norwegians travel to Amsterdam, they take surfers and they go to America, they go to Indonesia, they go to all these places all over the world. But of course, the Dutch were very active as well in the slave trade, which of course is a topic that has been heavily researched in the last 20, 30 years in the Netherlands, but even more so now. So actually recently, 1 or 2 years ago, a book appeared on the role of cities in the slave trade. Especially Amsterdam, of course. And we know that the Dutch were very active in slave trade in the Atlantic. Part of the things they've been doing is to make sure that the Spanish Empire was supplied with slaves from Africa, because the Spanish didn't have any footholds in Africa, and the Dutch did. So they transported a lot of slaves in the 17th century to Spanish America, and basically this was taken over in the 18th century by the British after the Peace of Utrecht. But the story that is much less known is that the feeling was always that in the East India Company, they were really interested in slavery. You know, they were dealing in spices and all these things. But we now know that this is not true. So also in Asia, the Dutch were very active in slave trade. And of course, you know, this is a very important story that needs to be told. And we spent quite a lot of pages in the book telling this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that we're discussing, like, just at a greater length all the time, and just incorporating it in the history. This is not a separate story. It's part of the broad story, right?
It's not just the, you know, the I was very interested also in the ethical discussions that were taking place, because what you actually see, and this is actually quite astounding, you know, you could argue that, say, you know, in the 17th century, you know, there was not a feeling that, you know, slavery was something wrong because everyone did this, but the Dutch story tells a very interesting it's a very interesting story, because in the early 17th century there were a lot of Dutch intellectuals, ministers in the church, who argued that slavery is a terrible thing. You know, it's really a sin. You cannot do this. It's what the Spanish do, and the Spanish are horrible. We know this. So we cannot do this. And slave trade and slavery was universally condemned. And then suddenly, in the early 17th century, this flips. And the West India Company becomes very interested in slave trade because it's profitable. And there were always people who were against it, but the voices sort of die down during the course of the 17th century. And then suddenly also ministers of the church also flip to say, you know, slavery is fine, you know, it already happened in the Bible, and, you know, it's profitable, so why not do this? And I was fascinated by this, that in the early 17th century, there's a lot of voices against slave trade. And then in the late 17th century, they sort of are silent. This is quite remarkable. We don't know why this is. You know, it's also a very pragmatic thing, because, you know, if you're a troublemaker, if you go to Suriname, where there were a lot of plantations, and you see the cruelties, and there are some reports of Dutch travelers who see the slave plantations, and they're absolutely horrified, and they're kicked out immediately. You know, we can't have these people here.
And so they're kicked out and shipped back home. Don't make any problems. So it's...
Yeah. And very few people do manage to, you know, to buck any trends or like supersede their era. That's just not what we as humans do.
That is true as, yeah, that's absolutely true as well. Yes.
Yeah. Very few people are able to kind of see beyond what is presented. So I think I've gotten here in the past few minutes, our discussion, I see the historiographical hole you wanted to fill, this kind of holistic global story. So do you have what you consider, can you tell me what you consider your overarching argument to be?
Ooh.
Sorry, like what a sucker punch right at the end there. With a book like this, it's really hard to say.
Yeah, it's really hard. Well, thanks for this question. I should have known this was coming. Basically, there are two things. One of the things is that we wanted to really present an integral story, in which Europe and the rest of the world are connected. So, and a lot of books about the Dutch Republic, about the Golden Age, are really about, you know, the Netherlands, and then there are other books about the East India Company, and we felt we really wanted to write an integral story. Basically, it is, as the title says, it is about the Dutch in the world, wherever they are and whatever they do. So that was the first part, but the second part is really the sort of things that we talked about, that we wanted to explain that global history is the history of a lot of different cultures and different people together, basically interacting with each other in very complex ways. And we really wanted to explore how, you know, Dutch history or Dutch identity is not something that is simply there. You know, it developed in conversation with other cultures, and it changes in conversation with other cultures. And I think that is, it's not an argument, of course, but that is really how we see the story developing in our book. And of course, that is a 17th century story, but it's still a very current story. You know, that is the story that we're still seeing in the process of globalization. Of course, it has a very different form now, but what you see here is, well, maybe the roots of globalization, of economic, political, religious, and cultural globalization. So this is sort of where it started. I think that's what we try to explain, explain and visualize and make clear to the reader in all these kinds of stories. And I don't have a specific conclusion. I leave it up to the reader. Read the book, read the stories, read the anecdotes, see how people lived and where they went and what they did, and come up with your own conclusions.
Great. That's an argument. That counts as an argument. Well done. That was a little bit of a kind of right here at the end of the interview. Let me throw in this major question. Well done. Handled it beautifully. So what was your favorite part of writing this? Do you have a favorite bit of the book or a really great memory you want to share?
I think the part that I really enjoyed most was the presentation of the artistic presentation of the 80 Years War. So the 80 Years War is really what, you know, the war of independence is for Americans. It's the 80 Years War for us. And what I thought was really great and fascinating was the way it sort of was presented. And you see this in paintings, is something we discussed, but you also see it in the landscape. And I never realized it. So if I drive here through the Netherlands and suddenly I see a hill or a dike or what they call here a schans, and suddenly I realized that, you know, this is really part of our very early story. So the way they changed the landscape to defend themselves against the Spanish. And also how the names, you know, a lot of the names of specific areas in the landscape, but also, of course, they are gone now, but of local inns, for instance, you know, inns used to have names of famous battles or famous persons who are fighting in the 80 Years' War. And to me, this was a new way of seeing the world around me, you know, the physical material world in the city and on the countryside, that you can really see the traces of the past. And we wrote a little bit about that, and Yeah, and that fascinates me whenever I drive around here. When we can, of course, because we are in lockdown. But, you know, out of lockdown, I'll see these things again. And I look forward to seeing them.
We all do, right? The in the aftertime when we can go places. Yeah, you know, I was looking at the map right at the first image in your book, and there's the Zuiderzee. There's like a body of water that doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's made into land, famously, of course. But you also see, you know, the other thing around what fascinated me is that Philip II built the Spanish Armada. He used so much wood that, you know, complete areas in Spain became deforested, and it completely disappeared. And Philip II was actually the first king of Spain who had a law that some wood had to be protected. You know, they were not allowed to. To get trees there, because you had to defend and take care of the environment. And that is actually, you know, for me, it's a sort of a next step. I'm very interested in religious history, but I've become increasingly interested in climate history. But that's for a very different other time, Jana. But traces of this you can find in the book when we talk about the forest and the sea and also the animals. And you know, it got me thinking that, you know, in a sense, what we do here in this book, it's very much human history. And of course, there's so much more than human history. So that's my next project. It's not about...
So, yeah, well, that was my next question. It was, what are you working on now? So an environmental history?
Yeah, sort of. It's starting. I've become very interested in missionary history, which is not so original, but global missionary history, especially in this period. There's very few people who worked on that. But I became interested in the way that Protestantism in particular, but religious institutions, what their attitude is towards climate. And you can see a little bit about this in the book, not so much climate, but at least the environment. And typically for the early modern age, people are not interested in nature. They're not interested in climate, obviously, because they don't know very much about it. But they're also not too interested in animals. And what you can see, of course, that in the 18th, 19th century, this sort of develops until we come to the late 20th and early 21st century, when this becomes commonplace. But there's a very famous argument is that the whole reason why we have climate change, and this is a lot to take in, I realize, but the main reason why we have climate change is because of philosophies, religious attitudes that were developed in Europe in the late 15th and early 16th century. And that fascinates me. And that is because European culture and Christian culture is very focused on humans and not so much about nature, which of course is very different from Hinduism or Buddhism. And so basically in the West, also in the United States, of course, a very Protestant state and in Europe, there's this development of Protestantism basically says, you know, it's about God and it's about humans. And nature and the world is just, you know, it's just a stage where history takes place. It doesn't really matter. We can use it. And
City of Man.
And I think and traces of this are in the book. And suddenly I realized that, you know, there's a world out there. You know, this needs to be explored. And is it really true? Is it true that in the 17th century people didn't really care about nature? You know, part of the story we tell is that they started to explore. You know, they started to analyze plants. They started to analyze even the climate in the 18th century. People started to understand that sometimes in Africa it's dry and some other times it's not. And so I think the story is a little bit more complex. And that's what it sort of comes out of this book. There is one chapter on mission history, and I try to develop that a little bit further. So the relation between religion and climate, which, as I don't need to explain to you, is a very important topic as well in our current world and in the United States, but also in the Netherlands. It's a major topic.
And you can see it. You know, I was just actually researching Cobus van der Sklossen, who's like the Dutch Robin Hood kind of.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because I have to do a presentation for my Dutch class, of all things. But there's all this conversation, like the stories are all about him and this band that hide out in the woods, these impenetrable dark woods. And I'm like, where are those?
Yes.
We don't really have those so much here anymore.
We don't have them anymore. They're disappeared. And of course, you know, it's like you say, you know, the idea that specific places have a moral connotation, right? So the woods are bad in the early modern age. Nowadays, we like the woods. But in the 17th century, the woods are something evil or bad and dangerous.
Yeah, the robbers, the wolves, they are dangerous. You know, but yeah, we look at them very differently now. And in part because they're not so dangerous. They're not full of robbers and wolves.
Yes. Yeah. Now, well, there are a few wolves now, but
not many. All right. Well, yeah. This has been a delightful interview. Thank you so much for taking your time with me. I'm really excited about this new missionary history.
Thank you. And thanks for having me. And it's nice to re-reflect on your own book. And thanks for some very good questions that made me think as well.
that's what I want to do. All right. Yeah, danke vel. And tot ziens.
Thank you. Danke vel, Jana.